former mayor, former congressman, and two-time presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich joins us this morning to tell us about his new book, The Division of Light and Power. It is an account of the hidden mechanisms of corporate power in the United States of America and what happens when these corporate interests are challenged. Kucinich gives an insider's account of his battle against a shadowy city government that emerged in corporate espionage, sabotage, price fixing, cutthroat competition, antitrust activities, organized crime, and wholesale fraud. That is, until Kucinich, then America's youngest big city mayor at age 31, fought back, risking assassination attempts and the destruction of his personal life. Again, the name of the book is The Division of Light and Power, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Dennis Kucinich back to the roundtable. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I really appreciate being on the roundtable with you this morning. I look forward to our discussion here.
Well, I look forward to it as well. Let me just begin with the fact that you made news this week by announcing you once again were going to run for mayor of the city that you were mayor of, Cleveland, Ohio, many years ago.
Yes, I did. And the Cleveland, of course, is much different than it was when I was first mayor, elected in 1977. It's about half the size, and it is really beset by crime and poverty, a tremendous amount of poverty. At least a third of the people in Cleveland are living at or below the poverty line, and about half of the children in the city are living in such conditions. So, you know, I'm hopeful that all the experience that I have at every level of government, local, state, federal, will be put to good use for my community once again.
You are only 71 years old, but it seems like a lovely way to maybe put a cap on a very rich political career.
Well, thanks. You know, when I was first elected mayor, as you point out, you know, I was 31 years old. And if you can imagine being America's youngest mayor and suddenly be confronted by these big corporations who were trying to force me to sell Cleveland's municipal electric system, and threatening the city with default on loans I hadn't even taken out unless I did. And so the story in the Division of Light and Power talks about a unprecedented battle that emerged between myself and these corporate interests and the outcome, which I think will interest all Americans in knowing that it is possible for one person, even a young person, to make a difference if you're willing to stand up to these to the odds and to the and to corrupt interests.
So the story, the name of the book is The Division of Light and Power. As I mentioned, you've been working on this book for many years, certainly intensively over the past 3 years or so. And there's a lot in this book. And I will ask you, at what point did you think, okay, this is 40 years ago, let's tell this story now?
It worked out this way, Joe. I began the book in November of 1979. At least I tried to, right after I left office. But I was so close to the events, I just couldn't do it. I mean, the reader, when you start to get into the book and realize the collision of these powerful forces, you can realize that as a young person, you know, it was pretty traumatic, actually. And it took me years to kind of sort out the story. And of course, I had all the documentation. What the book represents now is actually the seventh draft that I wrote over many years. So when I was in Congress for 16 years, I essentially put it aside because I was, you know, running pillar to post there. But as you said, you know, in the last 3 years, I just focused intensively, and I said, I have to finish this book. It was like haunting me. It was like I was carrying over 100 boxes of files around with me, like Marley carried his chains in Dickens' Christmas Carol, right. And I just couldn't shake not writing the story. So I finally was able to finish it. And I will tell you, a week ago when the first copy arrived of the final book, it's hard to describe the feeling. I was over the moon with happiness, actually having that finished product in my hand.
So at what point in your tenure as mayor, after you are elected, do you realize fully what you are up against?
Well, I knew when the private utility monopoly, which was trying to take over our municipal electric system, I knew when right after I took office, they started to attach, they used a federal court order to attach city equipment in the electric department and the light department. And it was really a shot across the bow. The previous mayor let a light bill build up for power that was purchased to buy the city from the private utility. And there was an $18 million light bill that built up. He tried to use that to justify the sale of the system. I wouldn't let that happen. But they used that bill as a whipsaw of the city right as soon as I took office. And we did pay that bill. But keep in mind, Joe, the reason why we had the bill at all is because the private utility, which is known as the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company, CEI, actually interfered with the city's attempts to fix our own generators so we could make our own power. And then they blocked us from buying power outside the city, and we could only buy it from them, and they tripled the cost. So, you know, this was just part of the corruption that was going on with this private utility making every effort to try to stop the city from owning its own municipal power system, which provided service at 20% cheaper than CEI.
Dennis Kucinich is our guest. The name of the new book is The Division of Light and Power. One of the things that I found fascinating about the book is your story comes in the late 1970s. And one of the things that you make, I think, clear is that there's really very little to stop what happened then from happening now, which is discouraging. But give us a sense, what changes have happened? And because you make the point that this could very well be happening in your town.
Well, that's right. Monopolies are stronger than ever. And not only that, you know, when the American Rescue Plan money, which cities have received and will receive in the next couple of years, when that money runs out, I can promise you that corporate interest will be licking their chops, looking at electric systems, water systems, sewage system, waste collection system, all those things to try to privatize them, to capitalize on them. And that will mean higher rates for people, higher taxes, more charges for service. And so this book is a cautionary tale which will equip citizens to be able to understand how to fight back. And past this prologue.
Let us talk about where the media fits into this story. I found this part of your telling very interesting because the media, you initially, I think, not to put words in your mouth, but you initially think that they could be helpful when you bring this to their attention, that you are exposing something, and yet you find great reticence on their part to do anything.
Right. And what I discovered was this, that one of the things I mentioned in the book is I'm in city council and I get this document delivered to my council office. I open it up and it's a secret account of how the CEI, the private power company, was usurping the media. They put it in writing and how they were actually writing things and getting it published verbatim in local newspapers. So they were causing coverage to be slanted in their favor and against the general public concerns on nuclear power and, you know, on and on. And then I saw it in action. For example, the top talk show host in Cleveland, whose name was Steve Clark, criticized the CEI's rate-making practices, and he was fired. And his number were off the charts. So there was no one else to compete with him in the market during afternoon drive time. But Steve Clark lost his job because he challenged the high rates that this utility was charging people. And in the book, I mentioned other news people who had great integrity, yet they lost their jobs because they tried to expose the misdeeds of the Cleveland Electric Illuminating Company with respect to their conduct vis-a-vis the city of Cleveland.
When did the national media start to get hold of this story? Because that did change when the national media came in and started to expose what was going on.
You're absolutely right. It began to change in 1978. Bob Scherer from the Los Angeles Times came in. Alex Colburn and Jim Ridgway from the Village Voice. And then Larry Kramer from the Washington Post started to look at it. And as the national media started to look at what was going on in Cleveland, it did affect the institutions in Cleveland to a certain extent. And the story began to get out nationally that was being covered up locally about the dirty tricks that were being played not only by the utility, but later on the banks. Remember, Cleveland went into default on December 15th, 1978, when the when the head of the biggest bank in Ohio, one of the largest banks in America, Cleveland Trust, told me, look, either you sell that electric system to this private utility, which the bank turns out was a business partner, or we, the bank, will not renew the city's credit on loans I hadn't even taken out, Joe. So I said no. They put the money to the debts. They wouldn't take any other payment except a sale of Muni Light. And then I got, you know, I asked the people of Cleveland to pass a tax to pay off the defaulted notes. The bank said, okay, we'll take you out of default if you do that. People passed a tax. The banks reneged on their promise and kept the city in default until after I left office.
So when you – was there satisfaction ever for you in the story of that you kind of got – I won't say revenge, but at least got justice?
Well, the justice was in 1993 when the city of Cleveland announced it was expanding an electric system that previously was said to be worth nothing, and the sale was attempted to be forced on the city. So – and that's it. I can tell you, the writing of this book and making people in Cleveland and nationally aware of this kind of secret history that took place is really, for me, the opportunity to start a new discussion about the untoward effects of corporate interference in the workings of government. It happens everywhere. I'm not opposed to corporations. I just think that, you know, when someone's elected, that the people have a right to be able to make policies through their elected officials, and that corporations shouldn't try to use their economic power to force decisions on the community if those decisions are not in the interest of the people.
When you put this into context, and I'll admit, when you were running for president, and I was unaware of this story and what you had gone through, but as I was reading the book, I mean, it really does put in context almost your entire political life, especially the time that you spent in the House and your interest in running for president. It really did influence you, and I assume you had many of these ideas coming in, but the experience, of course, gives you even more grit to go and say many of the things that you said about many different power brokers that you dealt with in Congress and that you dealt with on the campaign trail.
Well, you're right, Joe. You know, when I was I hadn't told the story. I didn't have time to write it when I was spending 16 years in Congress. But what I did have to do, based on my experience in Cleveland, being able to see through the lies that were told us about our electric system back then, I was able to lead the effort to challenge the war in Iraq. I saw through the lies then. You know, on October 2nd, 2002, it's on the Internet, I posted it. I did an analysis of the Iraq War resolution that proved chapter and verse why it was not the right thing to do. It was wrong, and the people we were being lied to. I gave it to every member of Congress, but, you know, we had 125 people who lined up with my leadership then, but I couldn't have gotten to that point unless I went through this experience in Cleveland, learned how to take a stand, learned to see through the lies, and stood up unafraid to challenge the for pushing us into a war.
Why were you one of the lone ones? Why is it so difficult to do what you did? I mean, I realize that hindsight is 20/20 for many, but you saw it before many others did. So and let's just take that issue aside, for someone to stand up as you did in the 70s in this particular case and what you're writing about in the book, why are there so few that are willing to take the step that you did?
Well, we all have different life experience. So, you know, I grew up in Cleveland, the oldest of seven children. My parents never owned a home. We, as a family, expanded a lot of trouble finding a place to rent. By the time I was 17, we ended up living about 21 different places, including a couple cars. So, you know, I was always very close to the street. And when you're close to the street, you develop a sixth sense of what's going on. You know what's, you learn what's real.
You're going in and out on your cell phone. I'm sorry. So just say that part again, if you don't mind. You're talking about your upbringing.
Yeah. Can you hear me now, Joe?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was growing up in the city of Cleveland, I was a big family, the oldest of seven. My parents were always having economic difficulties as the family expanded very quickly. Seven kids. We kept having trouble finding rent. By the time I was 17, we lived in 21 different places, including a couple cars. And, you know, I spent a lot of time on the street, and I developed a street sense. And that street sense informed me of what was real and what wasn't. And, you know, the tough weathering that takes place where anybody who's living in the inner city, if you happen to take that knowledge in the government, there's a lot of benefits to being able to assess what's really going on instead of, you know, what necessarily you're being told is going on.
When you think back to this event, and as I mentioned in the introduction, I mean, you fought back, but there were assassination attempts. There were people looking to destroy your personal life. I mean, that has to not only scare you, but just not that it changes how you feel, but it has to be scary. It has to be eye-opening, and certainly, how do you think of the governor of Michigan who, you know, there's a plot to kidnap her, and they find out, you know, that it's a real plot. I mean, these things do happen, so. How did you react to that and think, okay, because it would seem to me that if it were me, you all your priorities get kind of realigned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will tell you, when I started the campaign to stop the sale of Muni Lite, a high-powered rifle shot missed my head by a fraction of an inch. I was very lucky. I was not killed then. And when I became mayor, I was apprised by police intelligence that there was an active assassination plot. I never talked about it. The U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Organized Crime years later confirmed it. The head of intelligence came to my office one day, and I asked him, I said, what is going on here and why? He said, well, you know, this is all about the light system. You're stopping some people from making a lot of money who are trying to take over Muni Lite. How did I feel about it? I've got this faith, religious faith, really, that says you can't walk in faith and fear at the same time. You cannot function if you're fearful. You get paralyzed. And if you're in public life, you're a fearful person, you're in the wrong business. And so it doesn't mean that I wasn't concerned. Of course I was concerned. And so I took whatever precautions needed to be taken, and I went about my work, and I focused on the task at hand rather than to get distracted. And I think also the fact that I grew up, close to street-based fearlessness, because, if you're growing up in certain neighborhoods, you're in the rough and tumble all the time. I was very small. I found myself in situations that most people who are short might, if you're living in a neighborhood where there's gangs and people who aren't particularly happy to see you. And so, I had some weathering that went on before I got into public life based on my private life. So I was probably not the right person for the corporations to try to intimidate. Plus, we never really had much growing up. So I didn't rely on materiality for my comfort. And I didn't depend on even a roof over our heads. So when you come with that kind of thinking, if somebody says, well, they're going to take away something from you, you'll take away your office, whatever, I'd just say, well, I don't care. I mean, I'm here to do something for the people, and I can't be threatened in that regard. When people endure threats every day that they don't know where they're going to live, they don't know if they're going to have any kind of stability, they're always vulnerable. When you get through that as a kid, you come up as an adult, it can toughen you up, and it sure did me.
when you get toughened up now and you're running ahead, you're running again in the city of Cleveland. So what is the situation there, and how much can you talk about what happened that you're writing about in this book that will resonate with voters over the coming election season?
Well, what's happening now is Cleveland's, you know, being overrun by crime, murders, shootings, felonious assaults, carjackings, everything. All of them are up. Per capita, Cleveland's probably in the top cities in all those categories. I just got a report the other day that the shootings were up 56%, felonious assaults up 30%. Cleveland's homicide rate is up over last year, 12%, which was the highest in 30 years last year. There are people who are vulnerable here. They can't, you know, they're worried about walking the street at night in their neighborhoods. They're concerned if their kids go out during the day, they could get shot. They can't sit on their porch. They are in trepidation if they even go to get gas at a local station. You know, there are neighborhoods that are besieged by crime. And now hiring more police, but also creating a civic peace department so that we can address the root issues of society. Us, by the way, I'm talking about bringing in people with mental health expertise and social work expertise to answer calls, safety calls that don't require an armed response. But that's the crime issue that's paramount right now. And then there's a lot about 19% of the people in Cleveland right now are living on $10,000 or less a year. A third of the city is living at or below the poverty level. Half of the kids in the city are living at or below the poverty level. So crime, these are things that I'm, you know, I'm confronting, and not just in the campaign, but because of my life experience, I think I have some ideas that might be helpful in taking Cleveland in a direction that can take us out of these doldrums.
We only have about a minute, but have the demographics changed significantly since you last ran?
I would say it's cities half the size, but the demographics, you know, might be a little bit, you know, there's more African Americans than there are Caucasians in the city. There's a small population of Latinos. There are many different nationalities. Cleveland has, you know, probably 120 different nationalities represented. When I was mayor, the first time, half of my appointments came from the African-American community, even though at that point Cleveland had a Caucasian majority. So, you know, I've been known to work with all communities in Cleveland, and because of that, I probably have a pretty fair chance to get elected. Again,
right. Go back to the old office. Maybe you can get new wallpaper. Dennis Kucinich, I thank you very much for being with us. It's a great pleasure and honor to have you on our program. As always, The Division of Light and Power is the story. It's a doorstop of a book, but man, is it good. Dennis, thank you so much for being with us. I wish you all the luck in the world. Thank you.
Thanks for a great interview. Thanks so much, Joe.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Division of Light and Power by Dennis Kucinich. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.